This is the Blaze Radio On Demand.
Over 24 million people in the United States are addicted to either alcohol or drugs. It's a national epidemic, and it's killing more people than auto accidents each year. If you or a loved one are struggling with an addiction, what's your plan? Do you think it will just go away on its own? It won't. Are you embarrassed or ashamed to ask for help? Too many people are. Addiction is not a character flaw. It's a disease that, left untreated, destroys lives, families, and relationships. It will literally take everything from you. Get help. Get help now. Call the Addiction Advisor Helpline. Their advisors are there 24 hours a day to listen and provide guidance. The call is free and the service is free.
Call the Addiction Advisor at 800-278-9402. That's 800-278-9402. Again, 800-278-9402. That's 800-278-9402.
Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to the Freedom Hut. Thank you very much for joining. 888-900-3393 on the Broad Voice lines. A lot to get into today, which is always fun. So strap yourself in, because here we go. Let's kick it off with the latest on the Hillary email scandal. Here's the good part of this, is that it's actually kind of funny. Parts of it are funny. And then parts of it, it gets real. So we have these emails from Hillary that show, some of them are really entertaining, actually. The State Department published a lot of these emails last night. No surprise here, by the way. You've heard of the sort of Friday document dump before. This was the Tuesday 9 p.m. document dump. This was the State Department deciding that they were going to put all this stuff out there on a Tuesday, and that we late at night, of course, and that way there wouldn't be as much for it, would be old news. You see, it's already old news. They're like, oh, we let those fly last night. What's the problem here with the emails? I don't get it. I don't understand. Somebody explain it to me. And the press, by the way, with each new Hillary email revelation, just sort of stares at the latest information like a bunch of goats waiting for feeding time. No interest here at all. Nothing. What do you mean this is? Why would the public care about this? That Hillary said all this stuff about the secret homebrew email server she had that wasn't true. Keep in mind that this is entirely a scandal of Hillary's own making. And that even some of her more sort of stalwart defenders, even really true blue Democrats, would be willing, I think, depending on the venue, to say it at least privately, if not publicly, that this is totally unnecessary. She could have just done what other people have done in the past. If all the emails were already out there because they were already preserved as part of public record, as is required of an official of Secretary of State level, for example, this wouldn't be quite as interesting. But now, because there was clearly an effort to keep some of these out of the public eye, now we want to know. Now we want to see. And when you add to that all of the lies, right? Although, well, I needed one device for convenience. No, you had two, for example. Other people who have said that they didn't even know about this email address, and now we see, well, if they didn't know about it, it's interesting because they definitely emailed that address. So I guess they just got really lucky. You know, they just picked it out of the phone book. I think that is clearly not something that we could easily believe. So they published 3,000 of the 55,000 pages that are supposed to go online by the end of this year. It's a 9 p.m. release, which everybody realizes seems super sketchy. But let's get into the fun. I promise you some fun stuff. Let's get into the fun parts of this for just a moment, okay? This gives you a real picture of who Hillary Clinton is. Now, they're trying so hard to make Hillary the lovable grandma. Oh, Grammy, are you making me some booties? You know, for the grandkids with the knitting needles by the fireplace. And she's like, I just love America. All that stuff. That's the PR campaign. That's what they've been trying to do. But that's not going to work, because that's not who we're dealing with. And this is a new media environment. This is not the 90s. By the way, I think you can make a pretty convincing argument. We'll never know, because You can't change history, but I think you can make a pretty convincing argument that the Clintons would not have made it through two terms, that Bill would not have made it through two terms in office, would not have been reelected. Any number of things would have been different had the media environment then been the way it is today. This is not a new thought. Others have said this, too, but I just want to make sure we keep that in mind, that the Clintons, it was all the Clintons, 8 years of prosperity and relative peace and everything was great. No, actually, there was a lot of stuff that was despicable and disgusting, and there were a lot of reasons why he shouldn't have won a second term. But at that point in time, the media, which is 90 to 95% Democrat-leaning, remember, the first term of Bill Clinton is pre-Fox News. I mean, the first term of Bill Clinton, there was no media opposition, really. There was talk radio, there was Rush and some others who were blazing the trail, but there was no real opposition media. Think about that. It's like we're back in the Soviet Union or something when you put it in that context. I can't believe that that was the case, but it was. So that's the way the Clintons were able to get away with the shenanigans then. I think that they've been caught napping when it comes to the new digital media environment where they can put this stuff online and citizen journalists can actually find ways to go through it. There are a lot of people, there are a lot of individuals who will sift through this stuff and actually find ways or find things in it that are of public interest. Okay, so get the drum roll going here for a second. What are some of the fun things we've learned about Hillary? She has trouble with fax machines in a way that you would expect from a 75-year-old Latin teacher in the 70s. You know, I mean, that's the sort of level of technological difficulty we're talking about with the Secretary of State. By the way, you would hope that in the new digital media era in which we all live, there would be a baseline level of tech savvy, but that's not the case. That's not what's the deal with Hillary. So she has some of these emails. This is from Hillary to Huma Abedin, the wife of Anthony Weiner, very close aide, almost like an adopted daughter, I've heard her described as, almost like that for Hillary Clinton. You have, for example, can you hang up the fax line? They will call again and try fax. Just pick up phone and hang it up and leave it hung up. And then you have, I did. And then you have Huma respond to Hillary, yes, but hang up one more time so they can reestablish the line. And then you have Hillary responding, I thought it was supposed to be off hook to work. I love it. It's great. I mean, think of how ridiculed, by the way, Bush was by the media with that whole scanning things at the supermarket, which was completely taken out of context. It was a new kind of scanner. It was a different thing. And that was, they were touting it as, we have this new scanner technology, check it out. And he's like, okay, well, how is this new? He wasn't saying, how do you scan vegetables? I don't understand. Hillary, on the other hand here, is like, well, I open the fax line. I close the fax line. How do we send the magic paper over the phone line, though? Do I have to stuff it into the phone line? Are there little elves that take it and run it really fast? Doesn't seem like she knows really what's going on here. Now, look, there are some who are going to say that this makes her more human and likable. I think it's going to be more of a, wow, this is somebody who really hasn't bought her groceries, driven a car, or had to act like a normal person does, had to deal with normal person issues for most of her adult life, really, certainly the last 30 years. You should think about that as you're going through your work day today or this evening as you're at home. You should think about whether you want this person, whether you can believe this person who claims that her primary selling point. Remember, she tried executive experience and, you know, I've got mad skills, that whole thing. She tried that, right? She tried being the decider in chief, you know, the one who would get things done. And that didn't work for her. At least it didn't work when she was running against Barack Obama. So now the new Hillary, this is Hillary, I don't know, 4.0. You can tell me what version this is. There's been so many. The new Hillary is, oh, no, I care about you. I am your friend. I feel your pain, to borrow from Bill. I mean, she doesn't feel it like the way I feel it. Because, I mean, when I say I feel it, I mean, I actually, with my hand, with these little digits here on my hand, I'm going to feel that pain. That's a little different, right? It gets a little creepier. But with Hillary, she's trying to emote. She's trying to empathize. That's a big part of what's going to sell her to the electorate now. That's what they're trying to do. And so when you look at these emails, you have some fun with them. It's good stuff. What are some other fun? I'm trying to think of some of the other fun ones here. Oh, yeah. She also, you know, sort of writes off little emails about, you know, tell so-and-so to get me an iced tea, which I thought was pretty interesting. Kind of a fun way to go about things with Hillary. Can't get her own iced tea. It shows her being sort of imperious. It shows her as the opposite of what we're told she is, which is somebody who is particularly difficult to deal with. And there are plenty of people who've worked in the past who would say that that is the case. So she had the fax problems. There's one another email that's, would someone please get the secretary some iced tea? I told you about that one. And there was one other time when it said, I arrived for the, this is from Hillary, I arrived for the 10:15 meeting and was told there was no meeting. Matt said they had released the time. This is the second this time has happened. This is the second time this has happened. What's up? So they stood her up at the White House at some point. Hillary didn't know what was going on. I think you're maybe getting a small window of some kind into the fact that I don't believe the Obamas, I don't believe Barack Obama, President Obama, has any fondness for Hillary whatsoever. I don't care what anyone says. Go back and look at how that primary went down in 2008, and I'm sure you can still sense the sort of seething tension and resentment on both sides that exists between those two people. But nonetheless, another time she had Hillary heard about a cabinet meeting on radio. I heard on the radio that there's a cabinet meeting this AM. Is there? Can I go? If not, who are we sending? Secretary of State hearing about high-level government meetings on radio, which is an interesting way for things to go. Then you get into sort of some of the, and there's also a lot, there's a lot more sort of ridiculous stuff. You have that she wore a coat in Kabul and it was a, its favorability rating, according to the HuffPost, the coat she wore was 77%. Look, that's funny. I mean, she's a human being. You know, some of this is honestly just in all good fun, right? Some of this stuff is just entertaining to read about because it's Hillary Clinton, and you can sort of see her snapping the fingers saying, get me an iced tea. Look, maybe she couldn't get it at that point. Who knows? But then you get into some of the stuff that's more substantive, right? You get into the communications with Sidney Blumenthal, for example, which she hasn't been truthful about. And you get into some of the redactions in these emails. You say, well, why is that redacted exactly? Someone explain. There's some email that says Hamptons in the subject line. The reply is Hamptons, and that's all you see. Now, maybe that's just personal data. They don't want to put out addresses. I get that. But keep in mind that this is already email that's been sifted through by Hillary. She deleted over 30,000 from her server, so this is what's left over. So it doesn't prove anything. It doesn't prove anything at this point that there's no smoking gun. There's no, I'm going to go push for this policy for you if you donate $1 million to the Clinton Foundation. High five, Saudi Arabia. You know, there's nothing like that in these emails yet that we've seen, and I don't think you will see that because she had first crack at it, and she's not an idiot. He's going to pull out anything that's really bad. It's already been deleted. But there's some other stuff that I think we should just keep in mind. For example, here's an email from her that says, I spent yesterday with Les Gelb, he's a senior New York Times guy, if memory serves, on Nantucket. Of course. Where else would she be hanging out? He had to say, he had lots to say which might be of interest, but I thought the most important thing to you would be to make sure you're aware of the Parade magazine piece he wants you to do. This is to Hillary. He would like to do a day in your life when you meet with members of Congress and international figures. He wants to show the impact you are having domestically and internationally. He said he would give you a veto over content and looked me in the eye and said, quote, she will like it. Maybe you know this, did not want to fall in between the cracks and enjoy your vacation, blah, blah, blah. So the press will do profiles on Hillary and promise her editorial control over the profile openly beforehand. To say this is a lapdog media is just to state the obvious. This is grotesque. It is preposterous. So remember that as you see all the coverage of Hillary. Oh, she's so wonderful, right? They'll give her veto power. Literally give her veto power over pieces they write on her. How many Republicans do you think have that in major publications of any kind? Here's a big surprise for you. Zero. I want to tell you about something else for a second, though. There's a brand new, exciting way to get brand name guns, to buy them and get gear for just pennies on the dollar. And I'm talking to you about BidGunner.com. You see, BidGunner is an auction site. You just go to BidGunner.com and you'll see it. And you go there and you can bid on top quality firearm brands like Glock, Beretta, Ruger, Colt, many, many more. Here's how it works. Just go to BidGunner.com and register. You can place bids, you can buy bids, and if no one else bids, you can win. Just to give you a few examples, you can buy a Glock with a retail value of $403. It was sold for $5. A Taurus Judge with a retail value of $442 sold for $296. These are the lowest prices on the internet, so take it from me. Go to BidGunner.com for yourself. That's BidGunner.com. Again, one more time, BidGunner.com. Back in just a minute.
Buck Sexton, the Blaze Radio Network. The Buck Sexton Show. Speak your mind. 888-900-3393.
A couple of things happening in the foreign policy world that I think are of interest to us here in the Freedom Hut. One is that Greece has defaulted. So I guess we now have to update that old line. I fear the Greeks, or rather fear Greeks bearing debts, because it's going to be a problem for you. The latest here is that there's a new proposal for budget cuts and policy overhauls from Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras that has been dismissed by European officials. They're like, sorry, we're not going to accept this, because really the Germans are kind of running the show. I'm just saying. And this is now a situation where they're in default, but what does that really mean? And they're still trying to work it out. And they're probably, like, they're going to stay in the Eurozone, I think. I probably shouldn't say stuff like this because I could be wrong. And why make predictions and put yourself out there like this? But it seems like they're going to stay out there. So they defaulted on, or they stay inside. They defaulted on 1.55 billion euros to the International Monetary Fund. There's a great line that I saw yesterday from some European official who knew that they could, European bureaucrats could be so clever. He said, it's not a good idea to commit suicide because you fear death. That's his take on what the Greeks here are doing. That's what the Greeks have been doing at this point in time. And they're saying, well, you know, if you're going to do this and this is going to be terrible. So let's make it even more terrible. Let's make it even harder on ourselves. But that's, they're in a very difficult spot. Very interesting editorial, by the way, that Robert Kaplan, whom I think does some very good geopolitical analysis, he wrote in the Wall Street Journal talking about the role that Greece has played in all of this. And you have to understand the geopolitics and national security of Greece to really understand how we got to this current place, because really Greece should have never been a part of, from an economic perspective, from a dollars and cents green eye shade look at what's on the ledger perspective, Greece should have never been a part of the Eurozone. What's interesting is that Greece was very important in the Cold War to our side of things. Geographically speaking, Greece is very important, and it has been a battlefield, really, between the West and capitalism and liberal democracy and communism and statist control. The Greeks actually have a sort of different history with this. Even in the post-World War II era, they really have a, they've had, you know, Papandreou, for example, a former leader of Greece, was really more like a ruler. It was sort of more in the, along the lines of a strongman model. And you've had a very strong socialist and even communist sympathies in this country. And they still have a lot of anti-American sentiment, particularly among the Greek left, because they believe that we were using them as a pawn. We would say it was a front line, but that we were using them as a pawn against the Soviets. And so even when I was there, for example, I spent a summer in Greece studying, doing some master's work for a master's degree that I never actually finished or tried to get. But it was master's credit while an undergrad. I don't know why I'm telling you this. This is irrelevant. The point is, I was in Greece for a summer for about 5 or 6 weeks, I guess. And there was a lot of anti-Americanism there, and this was explained to me. Not necessarily as much in Athens. I was out in sort of the hinterlands. I was in Crete and parts of Crete that don't get as much tourism. And it's sort of like visiting America and going to the Midwest. You get a sense of what this place is really all about. What are the people like, right? I mean, you could show up here in Manhattan and anything. Well, it's the difference between Manhattan and London and a bunch of other places. It's a little harder to tell. But there's an anti-Americanism that exists there because the Greeks feel that we have, some Greeks at least, a lot of them really, feel that we have been meddling in their affairs. And the reason for that, we really have meddled, and this is now stretching back for decades, is that we really didn't want Russian, or at the time, Soviet warships using Greek ports. And we had bases in Greece. We were using Greece as sort of a forward operating base for our navy. And that's a place that has been important to us for the purpose of geopolitics. So we needed Greece to not go into the Soviet orbit, to go into the communist orbit, because it would have put additional pressure on, for example, Italy right away. Kaplan makes many of these points in his Wall Street Journal editorial. I'd recommend that you check it out. And so with that in mind, Greece's role in all of this, not just as an economy, but as a piece of geography that is caught between East and West, statism and liberalism, communism and capitalism, looking at it from that perspective, it's still very important. Russia recognizes this as well, and Russia sees that Greece is the sort of weak member of the EU herd. It's the gazelle that's in the back of the pack that's sort of barely able to get going. And if they're going to start to pick apart NATO and start to pick apart European unity as a means of pushing back on Russian expansionism, irredentism, and aggression, no better place for them to start than the Greeks, who need some cash. The Russians have some cash. Maybe the Russians can find a new place for some of their military hardware, for some of their naval ships. That's why Greece really matters to us. It's more than just the economy. President Obama said that. There's geopolitics involved.
You're listening to Buck Sexton. Only on the Blaze Radio Network. What team are you on? Get your Team Buck shirt now at theblaze.com.
Team, it would be hard for me to lower my expectations of this administration, and it would be hard to shock me when it comes to their foreign policy operations, what they've been doing, what their strategy, if you can call it that, has been. There is a strategy. I shouldn't say that. Whatever the strategy feels like on any given day may not be clear, but overall it is for the U.S. to apologize, retreat, and beg forgiveness from the rest of the world. Because we do bad things. We're a bad, bad country with bad people. This is the sort of animating belief of the American left, and it has manifested itself in the policies of this administration. I think it will be very hard at this point. It's such a shame that the American people were fooled for the second time with Barack Obama running for re-election, and there was this question about how his foreign policy was playing out. And, you know, Bin Laden was dead. General Motors was alive. What else do you have to know? Yeah, don't worry about that Benghazi thing. That means nothing. But now we've seen what's really happening. We've seen Russia's aggression in Ukraine. We've seen China building out bases in the South China Sea, telling us to avoid overflights of those areas. We've seen the rise of ISIS, the largest, most dangerous jihadist terrorist army since at least the aftermath of the Soviet-Afghan war with the rise of the Taliban, and probably even dwarfs that if we're going to line them up and do an order of battle, ISIS versus the Taliban at this point in time. Taliban may have controlled more territory, but I don't think it could call upon the same level of firepower and resources. But it might be close. But nonetheless, that was a big problem for us. And we had to fight a war against them because they allowed terrorist groups to set up and strike us here in the homeland on September 11th and before then as well. So that's the legacy, the foreign policy legacy of this administration up till today. But they decided to add another piece into this. Oh, yeah. Get ready for it. Ooh, here it comes. Cuba. Been a big issue for the administration in the last 6 months or so. They're trying to find ways to show that they have come up with solutions. You know, they've come up with ways to handle problems in the past, from the past, rather. And with Cuba, guess what? They're brilliant. They have this new idea, this new solution for us. They're just going to open an embassy there. Here's President Obama today announcing that we are taking the unprecedented in over 50 years step of setting up an embassy, a U.S. embassy in Havana. Play it.
Last December, I announced that the United States and Cuba had decided to take steps to normalize our relationship. As part of that effort, President Raul Castro and I directed our teams to negotiate the reestablishment of embassies. Since then, our State Department has worked hard with their Cuban counterparts to achieve that goal. And later this summer, Secretary Kerry will travel to Havana formally to proudly raise the American flag over our embassy once more.
Oh, great. You mean that's all we have to do? That's all that was needed was just say, you know what, we're just going to set up an embassy. What concessions has the Cuban government made? What have they promised in exchange for this? See, this is one thing that the Obama administration has never understood, that the actions that they take come with consequences, even in the diplomatic realm. Talking means something. sitting down with the worst of the worst, sitting down with dictators, sitting down with scum that have people imprisoned and tortured and executed, with any senior U.S. official gives them a mark of some level of approval or at least legitimacy that they flatly do not deserve and that the United States should not, the United States government should not confer upon them. But they don't view it that way. Look at how they deal with Iran. No preconditions, no change in Iran's support for terrorism. Doesn't even have to lay off the whole death to America, death to Israel thing. No, no, they just keep saying that. That's not just something they say. That is a policy of that regime. That is an animating ideological force inside Tehran. Death to America, death to the Jews, destruction of Israel. They say it all the time. It means something to them, but the Obama administration doesn't care. Let's just sit around and talk. Says, let's have a chat. Sit down with some European bureaucrats, too. We'll figure this all out. It's what they promise us. It's what they offer us. The president doesn't see it that way. He thinks that this is a brilliant step of strategery, if you will. Play the next clip where he explains how we're just breaking from the history here. No need to get stuck in that.
The progress that we mark today is yet another demonstration that we don't have to be imprisoned by the past. When something isn't working, we can and will change.
What does that mean? I love, by the way, change, as in hope and change. Hey, what did we get from this? What did we get in response from the Cuban government? Do you know what they've already said, by the way, according to Reuters? They are already claiming that the U.S., this is according to Reuters, that the U.S. must end radio and TV broadcasts into Cuba and eliminate subversive programs. We are opening an embassy in Havana, which means that we are recognizing the legitimacy of this thug punk government in Cuba. That's what we're doing. And they've just announced it. And Cuba is already saying this little tin pot dictatorship, this clown show down in Cuba, it's ridiculous. Except it's also tragic and terrible because of the human rights abuses and the totalitarianism and the slow, you can see it, the slow constriction, going back to the state as boa constrictor in Cuba, just squeezing the life out of the Cuban people over a series of decades. So a couple of strong men, which is a term I don't really use, authoritarians, mafiosi, really is what they are, so that they can run this regime for their own personal benefit. Go around dressed like they're some sort of great military leader like Castro. Oh, yes, it's great. They're already saying, OK, yeah, great. Guess what, America? If you want full relations, you're going to have to give us what we want here. Oh, wow. This is, by the way, the negotiating prowess of the Obama administration on display for all of us to see right here. OK, Cuba. We're gonna drive a hard bargain here. You're gonna have to do a few things. You're gonna have to release political prisoners. You're gonna have to liberalize your politics, allow for elections, and open up free markets. You're gonna have to do those things. And Cuba goes, no. And the U.S. government says, well, okay, you got us there, Cuba. So let's just open an embassy, and we'll give you more. We'll give you more. How can we buy you off? And you ask, why would they do this? The administration thinks this is an ideological win. The American left loves enemies of the United States. Full stop. That's just the truth. The American left has this idea in their heads that, yes, there's brutality and there are these regimes that don't respect human rights necessarily, at least for a little while. And, yeah, maybe they imprison and execute homosexuals. And, you know, oh, yeah, go back and look into Che Guevara for a little bit, by the way. You'll see some of this stuff. And maybe they do horrible things. But it's really our fault, you see, because there's a legacy of British colonialism and then America comes along as the global hegemon and, you know, markets and the IMF and the internationalists and the banksters and all this nonsense, claptrap. The left adopts it, though, wholesale as part of the central ideology. And so what do they do now? They find ways to buy off these regimes all over the world. Look at what we've done. Who have we bent to our will under this administration? I ask you that very straightforward question. Where have we gotten our way? Tell me the country. Tell me which country around the world has decided that because of administration actions and decisions, They have really changed course and changed policy, and we get a win. When has this government, when has the Obama administration come away from the negotiating table and looked like they got the better end of the deal? Do you hear the crickets chirping? What? Oh, things in Iraq, the pullout there, that was a great idea. Now that country has become a giant terrorist safe haven and free-for-all sectarian civil war. That's well done, Obama administration. Libya? Oh, you mean the country that's in the midst of a militia battle? And on the one side, we've got the kind of crazy jihadists. The other side, you got the really crazy jihadists. Just a quick boat ride, ferry ride into Europe, by the way. Yeah, that's not a problem. No, nothing to see there. You tell me where. Oh, yeah, China's made a lot of concessions to us. China's playing ball in ways we could have never imagined. Not a single thing they can point to there. There's nothing that we've been able to accomplish with regard to the pivot to Asia. Russia is just looking at us with every passing day and saying, wow, you guys just really don't have it in you anymore, do you? Russia knows. They have measured the will of this administration and found it wanting. It's just the truth. So we didn't get what we wanted with that. We haven't been able to push Putin to pull out the troops that he has obviously sent into Ukraine, as well as some of the other things. We'll talk about how the Russians now are looking into the legality of the Baltic states. That's one way to get around NATO. They were never out of the Soviet Union in the first place. Sorry. Property of the bear, so to speak. And now here with Cuba, the best example of all. What concessions has the regime made, the Cuban regime made, the Castro commie strongmen? What have they done that warrants this step of recognition? Nothing. We come away from the negotiating table with this administration doing the negotiating, and we have given them everything. And what do we get in response? Nothing. And they think this is clever and wise. It is astonishing. Yet again, the Obama administration is like the guy who shows up to the university lecture, hasn't read anything, makes a fool of himself in class, and walks out saying, you see what I pulled there? That was pretty good, wasn't it? And they didn't see that one coming. And I didn't read a thing. Did you know that? I didn't read a thing. Yeah, dude, we know.
Buck Sexton will be right back.
The Blaze Radio Network.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, the Broad Voice lines are open, 888-900-3393. Broad Voice gives us the crystal clear clarity to have the sorts of calls we like here in the Freedom Hut. Bart in South Carolina is joining us. Bart, you're on the Buck Sexton Show.
Hey, Buck. Shields, hi. I think we're going to
Shields, hi, my friend. What's going on? Good to hear from you.
Yeah, the whole world is falling apart here, Buck. At a local level, you know, with the flag issue, for example. At the national level, with our rights as Christians or as Americans being trampled on. And on an international level, you know, funny you brought up Greece, because we talked about Greece, I think, a couple times in the past. And at the time, we really didn't know what would happen. I still think we don't know what's going to happen, but there's a couple of interesting things about Greece, which of all the topics I could talk about, I decided on Greece because it's the one that pisses me off the least right now, you know. But
let's cut to it, Bart. Go ahead.
Yeah, I read something recently about NATO army, NATO spending on military. And what surprised me was that despite NATO headquarters and the United States and the British Prime Minister making all these promises about facing Russian aggression, or just being vague about whose aggression, but the need to maintain forces at a certain level and preparedness and maintaining.
Right. NATO acts like it's sort of like Top Gun, where the bad guys don't ever speak and just have some random star on their helmets, right? It's not totally clear who the bad guys are in NATO, just like in Top Gun. Go ahead.
Yeah, they don't want to offend you know who, but they. Anyway, there was a lot of chatter in NATO about maintaining military, right? And then a report comes out, says that in their budgets for this coming year, there's only three NATO countries that met or exceeded their quota. That
right, their military, their military obligations for under NATO. Right, go ahead.
Right, it was Britain was one. I think Poland was another, or Estonia, maybe Poland and Estonia, and then which was interesting, Greece was on the list, and that just seeing that makes me ask some questions. First of all, what kind of credit does Greece have that they can actually buy military hardware because they don't produce anything themselves? What kind of credit do they actually have that they can buy it for their armed forces? And two, why would Greece actually, of all the countries threatened by aggression, why is Greece suddenly modernizing or expanding the military? And, you know, when I thought about that, I was, of course, the first question remains unanswered. Who's going to sell them stuff? But secondly, why is Greece spending all this money? Well, obviously, it's because of Turkey, because Greece feels like it is becoming threatened by Turkish nationalism. So, you know, throughout history.
And by the way, that the Greek concerns about national security, especially if it feels like its future within the Eurozone is not as, and within NATO secure, perhaps even, is not as clear. I mean, just look at how desperately Putin has held on to Tartus, the port in Syria. You know, how that warm water port access is why they have propped up the regime there. The Russian government has done everything they can to keep Assad in power because they have a strategic interest, not just in that regime, but in that warm water port. There's nothing to say that in 5 or 10 years, maybe sooner, maybe later, the Greek ports won't be open to Russian warships if things change pretty dramatically there, if the economy, if they get out of the euro. You know, that's what's at stake here.
Well, there was an attempt couple months ago. There was a story out there saying that Cyprus apparently made a deal with the Russians for Soviet.
Right. And Russians have a very big interest in Cyprus, obviously. Russians are very involved there. And when the banking crisis hit and they were going to do the 10% cut from everybody's bank accounts, you know, Russia was very involved in all these processes. Well, anyway, Bart, thank you for calling in and sharing some thoughts on Greece. I didn't get to this yet. I'm going to get to it in a minute. Russia is openly challenging the legality of the three Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, separating out from the Soviet Union. This is some pretty belligerent stuff, my friends. We'll talk about that and also the terror threat coming up over the 4th of July. That and so much more. Team Buck, back in just a minute.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to Hour 2. Thank you for staying with me. Broad voice lines are open. 888-900-3393. Give me a call. Let's talk. It's a Freedom Hut. It's wild in here. All kinds of stuff going on today. Very much appreciate you being with me. Please go to Facebook.com/Buck Sexton. Like the page. That's a good way for us to keep in touch. You can also send me messages there. I'll be responding. Even over the holiday weekend, I won't be able to stop myself from getting up on Facebook and seeing what the team has to say. I've been talking to you about what's going on with Russia in sort of broad stroke, but there's this idea that's already out there that Russia's eyeing that the bear, the hungry bear, because the bear is always hungry, is looking at some other places to put down its paw. I'm going to really belabor this metaphor here. Put down its paw and see what it can get away with. Some people have talked about in Moldova, the Transnistria region, for example, which when you say it, you automatically sort of lapse into a Soviet-ish accent, Transnistria. But that's one possibility. Again, where there are Russian speakers, there is the opening for Russian agitation, and where there was Russian or Soviet control, there's obviously a history and a legacy as well beyond that, behind any possible agitation. And we're seeing how that might play out now. You see, Russia is having its prosecutor general review the legality of a decision from 1991 that granted the Baltic states independence from the Soviet Union. The move is, follows the, this is from Radio Free Europe. The move follows the office's ruling last year that Crimea was illegally handed to Ukraine in 1954 and is, of course, setting off alarms now in Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. So do you see the pattern? They looked at, does Crimea really belong to Ukraine? Russia says no, it belongs to Russia. And they decided to go and take it. Because they said, legally speaking, it's still a part of Russia. So let's have a little referendum there to give a little extra added layer of legitimacy. Once they did that, they decided to take it. The bear just bit off the Crimean Peninsula, and that's a done deal. No one even brings that up anymore. Got away with that one clean. It's an important port. It's an important strategic location. There's a Crimean War, in fact, because it was an important strategic location. So they were able to do that. And as we see in Ukraine, they have created a de facto Russian separatist or pro-Russian separatist state in eastern Ukraine, in Luhansk and Donetsk. And that fighting continues on despite the fact that there's a ceasefire. If you want to see some footage of this, actually, Vice, the sort of hipster news source and channel, they have a documentary. It's very good, an hour-long special on HBO, and they look at Cold War 2.0, which is something people have been talking about for quite a while, but also they show you some frontline footage of what it's like right now at the edge where the separatists, the Russian-backed separatists, meet the Ukrainian government forces. And it is a depressing, bloody, nasty slog. I mean, it is bad stuff going on there. That's in Ukraine. But you can see now they're already doing a little bit of agitation, a little bit of poking of these Baltic states, which are NATO countries, by the way. And they're saying, but really, were they ever not part of, were they allowed to actually leave the Soviet Union? This is Russian government saying this. The last place they said this about was Crimea, which they took a piece of. You'd have to be a fool to be in these Baltic states now and think that there's not at least the possibility of Russian agitation and aggression in those areas. How would they do it? We look at the playbook. Look at what they did in South Ossetia, what they did in Georgia. And these breakaway provinces of Abkhazia and South Ossetia, where they took off two little pieces of Georgia, just to sort of show Georgia who's boss. Not Georgia, different Georgia. This is the Russian Georgia. It's actually where Stalin is from. I always find it fascinating, I've told you this before, that sort of the great ultra-nationalists of all time, great not in the we think they're awesome, but great as in having impact in history, the most powerful, most potent ultra-nationalists of all time, come from the fringes of empire. Corsica with Napoleon, Stalin with Georgia, and Hitler, of course, from Austria, not from Germany. Interesting how that happens. You think that that might play into sort of the identity of the individual growing up. They're on the fringe. They have to feel more. Or they, perhaps they do feel more like they have to make some sort of effort to be the real deal of whatever the nationality is. But I digress. So looking now at what's going on with Russia, you have to see that there's a pretty clear pattern here. What they could do is say, well, there are Russian speakers who are pretty unhappy, by the way, in places like Estonia or Lithuania or Latvia. There are Russian speakers there. Maybe they decide that they want some kind of, you know, Russian, dual Russian identity, or they create a little breakaway province. They seize some city, some town on the Baltic Sea. They say, well, this is now, we're going to make this a part of something else. Well, whatever. I mean, it sounds crazy until they do it, right? It would sound crazy in Ukraine. They create some sort of a political agitation, and Russia says, whoa, 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 we need to help here. We're going to put in some peacekeepers. Bam, now you've got Russian troops there. And you say, oh, this is a NATO country, Buck. We would never allow that to happen. Well, you think? You want to place a huge bet on that? I'm not saying we wouldn't do anything if all of a sudden Russian tanks just rushed across the border into Estonia, for example. I'm not saying there'd be nothing that would happen there, but what if there are just paramilitaries who are showing up all of a sudden in Tallinn? What if all of a sudden in Vilnius, in some of these cities, you have Russian paramilitaries? But they're not actually Russian, right? Because they won't say they're Russian. They just have these individuals who start stirring up trouble. There's ethnic resentment, Russian speak, whatever. I mean, this you can see how they might do this. And then Russia says, oh, look, this is a problem. We need to create a safe space. And now I sound like Count Dracula, one, two. But you get what I'm saying. It's the same general idea. Lithuania, Transylvania, you know, tomato, keep all this stuff straight, it's tough. So that's what's going on there. So Russia's already saying, and even if they don't plan on doing this, it shows you how aggressive they really are and how bellicose the rhetoric can get. They're pointing out, look, if we want to try to take these little countries away, we're going to find a pretext to do it. And this is getting pretty scary. Those military exercises, these Baltic states are engaged in joint NATO military exercises, don't seem like they're for naught. That is for sure. And there are some who will say that one of the great successes of the 20th century is actually the creation of the EU, of the sort of Eurosphere, of as for all of its problems and all the jokes we make about it as a bureaucracy and everything else, to come out of the depths of the most extreme viciousness and bloodshed and misery and totalitarianism in Europe and come together with this country where the biggest problem is, you know, how much they're going to pay baristas and whether school is totally free or partially free. And, you know, no one's worried anymore about France invading Germany or Germany invading everybody. That's not a concern. That's a big geopolitical victory. And when you start to see what the world looks like when that comes apart, not necessarily they'll be fighting in Europe, but if Europe isn't a sort of consolidated entity on the global stage, things get a little messy. Things can get problematic very quickly. Let's take Steve in Oregon, who has a call. Steve, you're on the Buck Sexton Show. Welcome. Thank you for calling in.
Hey, thanks, Buck. I just wanted to give my two cents, kind of to confirm, you know, just add on to what you're saying. I got some firsthand experience to see what the U.S. policy towards some of the former Soviet states is recently. I just came back from Afghanistan a couple of months ago, and I was throughout different parts of the country, but what I realized it was a trend was, you know, all of the combat kind of jobs, all the security oriented jobs were being taken by Mongolia, Macedonia, Georgia, you know, the former Soviet states, or the ones at least within the sphere of, that are still within the sphere of Russia. And then Germany and France and, you know, what people consider to be like the more organic NATO countries are more friendlier to us, with the exception of the British. You know, they're just, you know, making PowerPoints for colonels and generals all day. You know, you got a Mongolian out with a rusty AK pulling security for a base. But, you know, the thing that struck me the most is when I was in Kabul, the unit that replaced our unit, you know, this is recently, so this is post-January, so the war is over now, but in quotation marks. But the unit that replaced us was a Georgian unit. And you know, they told us that there were going to be like 200 Georgians showing up at the base to guard it. And it really struck me because when they showed up, their uniforms, their military uniforms, look exactly like the U.S. multicam, you know, with, you know, a few minor variations. And they've gone as far as, you know, whereas like the other, you know, like Macedonia and Mongolia, they still have AK-47, 7.62 assault rifles, you know, the old Soviet assault rifles. Georgia's got, like, you know, M4s and American-made M4s, and they're, I think that they're trying to find, like, a big brother relationship or, you know, in case people forget, back in, like, was it 2008 or something during the Olympics when Russia went in and roughed up the Georgian army. But I think that they're trying to find allies in us in Macedonia and, you know, to some extent, the Czech Republic. And, you know, and they're taking these combat jobs out where, you know, you got a lot of, like, Italians just bribing the Taliban or, you know, just riding out, getting whatever money or, you know, whatever. But you got these.
The Italians, they made some really, really good coffee when I was over there, and they didn't seem to be particularly interested in combat patrols, was my recollection of the Italian presence in some parts of Afghanistan. I'm sure they've done some real fighting, but generally speaking, some of the, you know, not everybody's as interested in walking through the villages and trying to, you know, defeat the Taliban. That's all I can say. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, part of the reason that my unit even went out there is we were at first in Western Afghanistan, which is, you know, under the responsibility of Spain and Italy. But even though they were, you know, the headquarters or the commanders and, you know, we had to run stuff through them, you know, all of our combat operations, they didn't want anything to do with them. All, you know, they'd have their little, you know, pizza shops there for when we came back from patrols, but that was the furthest that they got involved.
All right. Well, thank you. First of all, thank you for your service. I'm glad you made it back. Thank you for serving your country. Appreciate it. Thank you for calling into the show. It's good to talk to you. All right, team, broad voice lines are still open, 888-900-3393. There is a terrorist threat that is being taken very, very seriously, more than anything we've heard in quite a while, for an attack on the homeland, and it's supposed to occur over the 4th of July holiday. Let's do some analysis on this and break it down in just a minute.
Buck Sexton.
Taking intelligence to a whole new level.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Sexton.
Team, there's a lot of talk out there, a lot of chatter about the chatter, if you will, terrorist chatter, that has apparently been elevated in advance of the 4th of July holiday weekend. So people are very concerned about this. Now, look, there is a certain ebb and flow to these things. And the authorities, as it were, the U.S. government and state governments, law enforcement, intelligence agencies, all the rest of it, they tend to want to make sure that they at least engage in what we used to call in the agency CYA, or maybe we call it CYB, cover your butt, and tell us all that there is something to be worried about. So if something does happen, they can say, well, we told you. It's not really clear to me why or how these warnings are of any substantive help to any of us, but nonetheless, nonetheless, this is an issue. This is something that we should look at for a moment here. You have former deputy director of the CIA, my former boss, actually, in the DI, the director of intelligence, Mike Morrell, who is on TV as an analyst. And he's saying that he thinks that this threat, this 4th of July terrorist threat, is very real. This isn't routine. Listen to what he has to say.
So these kind of warnings go out routinely, but there's nothing routine about this particular one to me. This one really resonates with me for two reasons. One is there's been about 50 people in the last 12 months who've been arrested in the United States for being radicalized by ISIS, wanting to go fight there or wanting to conduct an attack here. So there's a lot of people out there who are seeing themselves as aligned with ISIS, number one. And then number two, you have this ISIS call to arms during Ramadan. We are right in the middle of Ramadan. Call to arms, conduct attacks against our enemies. So I'm worried about this one.
What does this mean for Americans on 4th of July?
I don't want to tell Americans what to do or what not to do. But, Nora, I wouldn't be surprised if we're sitting here a week from today talking about an attack over the weekend in the United States. That's how serious this is.
Classic intelligence analysis at work there, telling you things that you pretty much already know, but saying it in a way that it's presented as though it's new, and then leaving open the possibility that it's anything can happen and you will have said it could happen, right? This is the old joke about how he doesn't want any analysts, or they say this in the agency. I forget who the first one is who said it. I'm sure some of you will tweet it at me in a second. But they only wanted one-handed analysts because CIA analysts love to walk around saying, well, on the one hand, well, on the other hand, you know, is there going to be an attack? Well, there could be an attack for sure, but also there could definitely not be an attack. Okay, well, what does that mean? This is classic. The DI, the Directorate of Intelligence, which is where I used to work, this is the way things used to be done there, right? We're always, you know, oh, well, let's look for some way to sort of, you know, hedge the bets. And that's not a good thing when you're trying to do predictive analysis, which they always shy away from, but they also want at the same time, right? The agency is always just getting pulled in different directions, particularly the analytics side of it. It's just, you know, well, what are we doing? So there's this threat that's out there. Now, what he's really saying is that given the overall threat picture, things seem particularly problem. It's ominous right now. And that's actually a sort of follow on to what House Intelligence Chairman Devin Nunes said, but maybe a week, maybe 2 weeks ago. Do we have that clip, Stephen? Chairman Nunes, do we have him saying that this is the biggest threat we face in the post 9/11 era? Yeah, let's play that.
We face the highest threat level we have ever faced in this country today,
including after 9/11.
Including after 9/11, and there's a couple reasons why. One is the flow of fighters that have went from Europe and other Western countries like the United States to fight in Iraq and Syria who have now come out. We don't know all the people who have went in, nor do we know the people who have been back and are now on the streets in the United States. The FBI director said there are cases open in 50 states.
So there you have it. A broad threat picture here, but really what's unspoken in much of this is that when we're talking about the increased threat to the homeland, and this is, we all think about this, or at least some of us will think about this over this next weekend. I think a lot of us will think about this over the next few days, which is that why is it that we have not been hit? Why have we not been attacked in a major mass casualty way on U.S. soil, given how easy it actually is? You look at what happened in Tunisia. One guy with an AK-47 concealing it in an umbrella was able to kill 30-some-odd people. Just walk down the beach. So it clearly can happen, and it's obvious that it can happen, and it has happened here in the past. So we have to wonder, why doesn't it happen more frequently, or what would prevent it from happening? That's a part of this. On the other hand, I said one hand on the other hand, you look at statistically, what are the chances that over the next few days an attack will happen? It's rather low. We've been very lucky, as well as pretty vigilant, and there have been a number of disrupted plots. But the luck has been, I think, also the most critical factor in recent years. I can't emphasize enough how different the Obama presidency would look. And always remember this. If on Christmas Day, 2009, the Farouk Abdulmutallab, the underwear bomber, just manages to do things a little differently. The bomb is constructed a little differently, and he brings down a packed airliner with a couple hundred people on board right over Detroit. How differently the administration, oh, then the whole bin Laden is dead, General. So, well, yeah, but we got hit. And people say, well, that didn't happen. I say, yeah, it didn't happen because they didn't pull it off. But we got lucky. We've had to rely on it. The same thing with the Times Square bomber here in New York City. A case that I worked when I was at the NYPD Intelligence Division. Same thing. He constructs that bomb differently. We have hundreds of casualties in Times Square on a busy Saturday evening. So they look at this now, and I think there's an impulse from the government to tell us to be vigilant so that at least they're covered in that respect. But that doesn't really let us do very much. There's not very much we can do. And I would say that I think that this is primarily that. I think that this is mostly the government warning so that at least they can say they have warned us. But at the same time, there's nothing we can really do about this. And we sort of sit around and think, well, we hope that our luck on this issue continues. So, my friends, go and celebrate the 4th of July. Don't let this linger too much in your minds. But be vigilant, because the bad guys are coming for us at some point. Back in a minute.
Buck Sexton, The Blaze Radio Network.
Get your Team Buck t-shirt at TheBlaze.com.
All right, Team Broad Voice lines are open, 888-900-3393. Go to Facebook.com/Buck Sexton. Please check out the page there. Like the page. Share it with friends. Say, hey, have you been to Buck Sexton? Have you been to Facebook.com/Buck Sexton? And if they say no, say, well, you should, sir. Well, you should. Let's take a call here from Tom in Atlanta. Tom, you're on the Buck Sexton Show.
Hey, Buck. How you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for calling in.
Yeah, this is something you were talking about earlier about Cuba. I thought it would be pretty funny, Obama, trying to get relations started with Cuba. I would imagine the first thing on his agenda would be to start up a cash for clunkers program down there.
One way to go. There's a lot of clunkers, from what I understand. I have close friends who have been down to Cuba. I mean, I would never go because of my previous U.S. government affiliation. I wouldn't trust, you know, I don't trust that government, so I'm not going down there, sorry. But I have friends who have been down there, and they say that, you know, it's sort of a Back to the Future experience in the sense that there are like 57 Chevys driving around, although in really crappy disrepair. They've got like, you know, a chicken wire fence for a door kind of a thing, but.
Exactly. Well, that's just his mentality, that he would want to start a program like that with all their automobiles and get something rolling, you know.
There will be a glut in the sort of classic antique car market, I think, possibly, but that's not enough to get these things going. But what else is on your mind, Tom?
That's about it. I just thought that was humorous, that would be something that he would do. I don't anything he does, it just kind of confuses me. So I just thought that might.
Well,
have
Tom, we appreciate humor. We appreciate humor in the Hut. So thank you very much for calling in, buddy. Shields High. Thanks for your call. This is an issue that I get particularly angry about because I spent, as I've been, I tell you exactly what my jam was in the past, what my deal was. And I was CIA, CIA analyst, Iraq, Afghanistan, a little bit of Africa time, too. Maybe we'll talk about that another time. And spent some time at the NYPD intelligence division. So I had interaction. Obviously, I was working in law enforcement, but also interaction with the prosecutorial side of things as well. And I was, that was really a moment of realization, sort of the recognition of, wow, this is how it goes, because prosecutors have so much power and the check on that power is really limited. The sanctions available or the sanctions that can be used against prosecutors are minimal. Honestly, I mean, they have to pull a Nifong. They have to go full Nifong, who is the DA in the Duke Lacrosse rape hoax, who is just completely trying to sandbag those guys, just completely trying to stack the deck and you know, blank them over. You have to go to extreme lengths. And even then, you're probably just facing loss of your job and maybe disbarment. Whereas, for example, for a civilian, for just a normal person, you and me, if we bring a false charge against somebody, that's considered very damaging. If you lie and say that somebody broke into your house and stole all your stuff or whatever, or if you lie in some other capacity and that person is arrested and such, there's a harm done to them. And so to knowingly lie and do that to somebody is a crime. It's filing a false report for you, for me. But for a district attorney, if they go rogue and they decide that they're going to use the law as a weapon, particularly as a weapon of politics, not a lot. Not a lot that's going to be done to them. And now we turn to the Scott Walker, John Doe investigation fiasco. A piece today in the Wall Street Journal entitled "Why I'm Filing a Civil Rights Lawsuit" by Cindy Archer. She's one of the targets of these John Doe investigations in the state of Wisconsin. Her subheading here is "Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm and his agents ransacked my house and ruined my career." Now, if you read that and you don't know much about the story, you think, well, was Miss Archer part of some sort of massive financial conspiracy? Was she a drug mule for the cartel? What was she doing? Oh, no, that's nothing. No, the answer to that question is nothing. She did nothing wrong. No criminal charges brought. And what was she even suspected of doing? Coordination, policy coordination between the governor and a PAC or something? Some sort of a First Amendment violation? The First Amendment protected us. Apparently not. Some sort of a campaign collusion violation? Let me read to you from her own account in this Wall Street Journal op-ed published today of what it's like to be targeted by a pro-union, leftist, progressive, Democrat district attorney in a state like Wisconsin. What is it like when the slime monster of the progressive left decides to come after you? "Nothing could have prepared me for waking up to the shouts of men with battering rams announcing that they were about to break down my door on that morning in 2011. It was so unexpected and frightening that I ran down from my bedroom without clothes on. Panicked by the threatened show of force, I was then humiliated as officers outside the window yelled at me to get dressed and open up. I quickly retrieved clothing and dressed as I unlocked the door. Agents with weapons drawn swarmed through every part of the house. They barged into the bathroom where my partner was showering. I was told to shut up and sit down. The officers rummaged through drawers, cabinets, and closets. Their aggressive assault on my home seemed more appropriate for a dangerous criminal, not a longtime public servant with no criminal history. After they left, I surveyed the damage. Drawers and closets had been ransacked. My deceased mother's belongings were strewn across the floor. Neighbors gathered in small clusters at the end of their driveways, and the press arrived in force. What prompted the raid? My guess, as an advisor to Governor Walker, I'd played a lead role in drafting and implementing public employee labor reforms that would propel him to the national stage." End quote. She knew. This was payback. This was union thug payback via the prosecutor's office, the district attorney, Chisholm, in Milwaukee. And as I have said to you before, this was not just about payback for Act 10 and for the unions, but this soon turned into Scott Walker, a rising star in the Republican Party, a current presidential candidate, was a target for the Democrats, was a target for prosecutors. This is part of their strategy, and it is stuff befitting the Soviet Politburo. This is the sort of thing they do now. The charges against Governor Rick Perry of Texas, completely preposterous. Criminal charges against him. The charges against Scott Walker that they were hoping to be able to bring but could find nothing. The investigation and hope for charges against Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey. The complete annihilation of former governor and former presidential possibility, at least, Bob McDonnell of Virginia. They keep bringing these cases and either dramatically inflate any wrongdoing or find wrongdoing where none exists because the process is the punishment. All they have to do is find a way to put you into the machinery, drop you into the gears of the prosecutorial machine, where we know Democrats reign supreme, and they will find a way to hurt you. You've already been hurt. They will bleed you even if you've done nothing wrong. That's the point of all of this. And if you are just a regular person doing a job, trying to live your life, pay your mortgage, go to church, buy groceries, maybe go for a little stroll, I don't know, maybe do whatever it is you want to do in your free time when you're not working, trying to pay your bills, you can get crushed. And these progressive prosecutors like Chisholm, these leftists, these Obama supporters and Obama voters, obviously, these people who applaud the Supreme Court acting as a separate legislature, a sort of supreme government above the government, those same individuals, those same kinds of people sharing that ideology, they decide that it's time for payback and you are done. This editorial should be read by every honest, decent American in this country, and they should feel a queasy, disgusting surge in their stomach. This should make you want to vomit. Chisholm, the district attorney in Milwaukee, in Wisconsin, should be disbarred. He should certainly lose his job and then be disbarred. And he should also face financial ruin for what he has done to this woman and to others, by the way. Why am I so certain? How did I know? And those of you listening to the show know that I've been on this from the very beginning. Thankfully, Kelly File over at Fox News and some other big national platforms have taken on this issue and have made this a case that now people are aware of. But in the very early stages, you had to try to get some local coverage of this from the ridiculous communist rags in the state of Wisconsin, right? Milwaukee Journal Sentinel or whatever it's called. You had to hope that some of them would cover this. And occasionally the Wall Street Journal would crack into this, and then a National Review got involved as well. But if it wasn't for that, we wouldn't even know about this. This is like the unleashing of the leftist new American Stasi on some poor woman who didn't do anything. And the cops, and yes, I'm sorry, they're a part of this too. The cops who show up with battering rams to a woman's home because they think she may have been involved in campaign coordination should hang their heads in shame. In shame. They are a disgrace to the badges they carry. It is absolutely unacceptable. How could anyone in our country? We get so outraged about all this different stuff. Oh, we're so outraged about the fact that you can buy boxer shorts with a Confederate flag on them somewhere. How about being outraged about the fact that prosecutors entrusted by the public to do justice with immense, with vast powers to ruin lives are acting like they're DNC hitmen for the cause? Trying to eliminate political rivals, eliminate political threats, do whatever they have to do. This guy's a disgrace. He's a nifong. He is a nifong and should be treated as such. His name should live in infamy across the country. Why am I so sure he missed? Buck, how do you know that he's done this? Oh, Well, let's get into some of this. Mr. Chisholm, this is the prosecutor, had campaigned for Governor Walker's Democratic opponent. According to the sworn testimony of Michael Lutz, a former Milwaukee police officer and lawyer who worked in the district attorney's office in 2011, Chisholm allowed his deputies, as many as 70 of whom signed a petition to recall the governor, to post pro-union blue fists on their office walls and attend anti-Walker rallies during office hours. By the way, my friends, that is in fact a criminal offense. You cannot go to political rallies on government time. That's taking money from the public. That's theft of services, as we would have called it in the NYPD. Maybe there's some loophole in Wisconsin where you can do this. But you cannot send, you cannot on the taxpayers' time and dime, send people to a rally. And you certainly can't have blue fists of the union adorning your walls in the midst of a major political fight when you are the prosecutor's office. As Mr. Lutz testified, Milwaukee County District Attorney Chisholm made it his duty to stop Governor Walker from succeeding with Act 10. Apparently, Chisholm's shrill and irritating wife is a union flunky, is like a union organizer, right? So she goes home, she cries, oh, they're destroying the unions. The unions are the heart and soul of America. And this guy goes, oh, okay, honey, let's just find a couple of low-level bureaucrats and ruin their lives and terrify them with the police. This is a disgrace. Ms. Archer ends her piece here by saying, my reputation and career have been damaged beyond repair, but knowing what I know now, there's a clear legal path forward. There should be no place in America where powerful law enforcement officials are allowed to misuse their offices for political purposes. She's darn right. This should become a national cause. This should become a major news story. This guy, if you want to talk about making an example, this prosecutor must be made an example of. Look, there are ways. I mean, the NYPD, I'm very familiar with this. He should be charged with official misconduct, which is a very broad and very sweeping statute that applies. And I'm sure it exists in Wisconsin. It certainly exists in New York City. I'm aware of it in New York City, which really just means that you did stuff that you shouldn't have done, and it's so egregious that they're going to prosecute you for it. What he did should be considered criminal. It's so obvious. It's so blatant. It's so heavy-handed. It's so politicized. We have things, we have laws like the Hatch Act, which prevents any sort of vague federal activity that could be construed as partisan in U.S. federal facilities on government time. And people wave that around. And the people who wave it around, by the way, are also the, you know, make peace, not war, nuclear free zone, leftist, pro-Obama, Prius driving hippies. Yeah, you can't do the Hatch Act. Yeah. So I'm sorry, I can't talk about freedom and patriotism and liberty in a federal building, because that obviously is associated with the Republicans, not the commie Democrats. This should be a much bigger issue than it is. And we shouldn't rest until this prosecutor is out of office, done, no longer has a legal license, and I hope he is bankrupted by this lawsuit. And if there's anything I can do to help this woman, anything any one of you can do to help, we absolutely should do it. This is about justice. This is about rule of law. This is about whether we're going to live in some kind of a totalitarian Stasi state or not. The Democrats play filthy dirty. It's time we put a stop to it. Back in a minute.
You're listening to Buck Sexton, the Blaze Radio Network. This is the Buck Sexton Show.
Team, I got another 2 hours of show in my head, and unfortunately we're out of time for today. Don't worry, the Freddie Gray case and Prosecutor Marilyn Mosby have not escaped my attention. The eye of Sexton will be turned on them in just a matter of days. In the meantime, I want you to have a great 4th of July weekend with your family. Chris Salcedo is going to be in for me tomorrow, so you can hang out with my man Chris. Please go to Facebook.com/Buck Sexton, like the page, post there. We can talk over the weekend. Show me your photos of what you got going on for the 4th. Happy Independence Day, everybody. Shields high.
Buck Sexton, the Blaze Radio Network.
Paid non-attorney spokesperson, Adam Pulaski of the Pulaski Law Firm with principal office in Houston, Texas, is the attorney responsible for the content of this ad. This ad is not legal advice, and the choice of a lawyer should not be based solely upon advertisement. Services may not be available in all states.
Attention Xarelto users. If you or a loved one took Xarelto and suffered a serious bleeding event, you may be entitled to financial compensation. Xarelto is a popular prescription blood thinner used to prevent blood clots and protect patients from strokes. These serious bleeding events have led to numerous cases of hospitalization and even death. Phone lines are open 24/7. Call 800-630-6720. That's 800-630-6720.